Let's just kind of go ahead into this. I mean, the whole point of this thing right here, John and I were talking the other day, and I was just kind of making a comment, kind of off the cuff, or cusp, or whatever you want to say. And we got talking about how a lot of, when you talk about qualifications for people and trainers and things like that, one of the things that everybody seems to talk about, throw out, is that they train athletes. And, you know, it almost seems like a prerequisite nowadays, especially online, when you see someone's credentials that, you know, they put in there that they train athletes. And John kind of made I'm not even going to say it's off the wall, but it was just kind of a pointed response saying that, you know, training athletes is actually pretty easy and actually shouldn't even be, you know, more or less a qualification for people. So I guess we kind of wanted to go into that a little bit today and, you know, kind of explore that a little bit because, you know, like I say, I mean, if there's something out there we need to demystify and debunk, then we're going to do that. So, John, just kind of tell me what you meant by that and let's go from there.
Okay, there's a couple levels to why I said it that way, and I guess it does need some clarification. First of all, athletes are highly motivated individuals who they're drawn to the sport that they're playing, and they're going to work hard regardless. So one of the major variables that a trainer or coach that a lot of people are looking for in one of them is taken away with an athlete is the motivation and this intrinsic motivation an athlete has. Most people don't have that. That's why they're not. That's part of the reason why they're not a high level athlete. So that part's taken care of. Athletes are just going to do the work. I mean, they're going to get the job done. All you got to do, they're like a laser beam. You just point them in the right direction. So that part's easy. The second part, so that part's the motivation part. The second part is anyone who's, you know, beyond the age of about 12, like any kid can play a sport, but a true athlete, when you're getting to the varsity level, the semi-pro and pro levels, and all levels of pro, like farm systems, right up to the show, they're genetically gifted. That's why they made it that far in athletics in the first place. There's only so far you can take a body that's not a genetically predetermined athletic body. So that doesn't mean you can't build muscle, doesn't mean you can't get into great shape, and you can't become more athletically inclined for your given body. But there's a difference between someone who does all the right training and ends up playing, you know, starting running back for the USC Trojans, and someone who does all the right training and gets cut from the high school team. Like it's the raw material you're starting with. Like there's certain bodies are just built better, and then they respond to training easier, and then there's the intrinsic motivation. So athletes have both things on their side. They're motivated, and they're usually genetically gifted to begin with. So just about anything you do with them seems to work. It's kind of like hand-picking your subjects for a study to prove that your training system works and that your, you know, that your diet works. Well, I mean, if you're hand-picking the best of the best bodies to begin with, of course all of your systems are going to look like they work really well because you're applying them to, you know, people that are predisposed to be great at everything and they have the motivation to push hard. So anyone who said the real trick to training athletes is depending what field you're in is in the pros, it's dealing with their egos. And in college, it's dealing with their sort of, you know, I don't know, arrogance and immaturity. So it actually has nothing to do with being an intelligent trainer. It's more to deal with the personalities. I think that's also why some coaches can handle pros better than college, and why some college coaches, when they go to the pros, are like, I hate this, I want to go back to college. An interesting story, I had a trainer, athletic trainer I used to collaborate with and bounce some ideas off and get some, dig into his head and get some of his ideas. And he trained, he was the athletic trainer for, and the strength and conditioning coach for one of the football teams here in Canada. And at one of the universities, I was a strength and conditioning coach. I was a strength and conditioning coach for the hockey team, and he was doing the football team. And so I got some ideas from him, and not everything transferred, mostly because the hockey players do everything on skates, so it's really hard to come up with systems in the gym that mimic skating. So, I mean, but we still collaborated. And he went on to be a pro strength and conditioning coach for the Charlotte Bobcats basketball team. And, you know, he didn't like it, and he came back, and he just would rather train with. He would rather work with the college guys here in Canada, and he, you know, and then most people were like, "Wow, you got to train like a pro team," and he's like, "Eh, you know, it was more putting up with them just sort of, you know, their attitudes and egos. And I'm not saying all pros are like that. All I'm saying is it isn't that big of a deal being around, you know, elite-level athletes, because they kind of were elite-level athletes whether or not they did any training in the first place. I don't know if I can say it any more simply than that. And basically, when you apply a smart training program to them, that takes them from being, you know, a third-round pick to a number one pick. You know, it does make differences, but, again, you're dealing with the best of the best, both mentally and physically, to begin with. And so that kind of, to me, makes training with that. And I've trained with all different levels of athletes, so I don't really – I mean, they're easy to work with. That's – I mean, it's great because you get results. They're motivated. They show up. I mean, I enjoy working with them, but anyone who's highly motivated – I've worked with military guys. I've worked with bodybuilders. I wouldn't really call bodybuilding an athlete as much as it is. They're just at the highest level of physique augmentation and actually changing the way you look. So – and they're highly motivated too. I mean, anything you write on the page, you know that they'll do, and anything you recommend, they'll do it like right to the button. And that's like, you mean I could do that kind of training all day because they actually follow through with it. So training athletes is, you know what? Maybe it's the reverse thing around. Like after training an athlete or training a high level bodybuilder or fitness competitor, and you see the type of results they can get when you're dealing with somebody that's that highly motivated. Maybe you assume that you can do that with everyone, and the disconnect is when you realize, oh, wait, the average person isn't that motivated. They want what those people have, but the huge intangible that no one ever notices who's never trained with somebody that level is that the dedication those people have and the actual they just won't miss a workout. They won't mess up on their diet, you know, when it's competition time or preseason. They just don't. It's in their value scale of what's important in a day. It's right up there. It's one and one A bat in their career. Like that thing is that important to them. So, they're easy to work with. So anyone who says if that's your major claim to fame that you've worked with athletes, it's like, well, there's, so what? Like tons of people work with that. Think of how many high-level collegiate teams there are and how many pro teams there are. There's thousands of people that work with athletes on a daily basis. So, and all of these athletes are all performing pretty well. So I don't think there's any one special technique that one group is doing, you know, better than another. And on top of that, there's only so many ways the human body can move anyways. Like, there just isn't that much crazy stuff an athlete's doing that you couldn't also do. So it's... I don't know if that makes a whole lot of sense, but I hopefully that brings you feeling closer to that. Oh yeah, I mean, training like an athlete it sounds good, but it doesn't mean it's there anything special if anyone says that they've trained a high level athlete. Does that make sense, Brad?
Yeah, I guess the whole point of what we're trying to get at, or what I was saying, and then what you kind of came back at is that. Is that experience directly translatable, or, you know, can you extrapolate that to someone who's, you know, 260 pounds and have never worked out and things like that? I mean, it's, you know what I'm saying? I mean, I know how to. I mean, I've been in different industries where I have certain, you know, experience doing something, and then there's something that's similar that, you know, I should be able to do, but there's a totally different methodology to it, even though it's very similar, just kind of like what you were saying about mindset and where people were. I mean, is all this experience, is it, what's the word I'm looking for? Is it even relevant?
Well, yeah, and that's what I was getting at. It's got to be relevant to some degree. Like, anyone who's gotten themselves to the point where they're working with an elite athlete, I guess the credential there means not necessarily the system you put in place. But if I've gotten to the point where I've trained varsity people and I've trained pro people, that means that at least those people have some faith in me and what I'm doing. And somebody somewhere, an athletic director, you know, a coach, somebody trusted me with their people, with their team, right? And then the athletes themselves trusted me. And then if I didn't completely ruin what they were doing or you know, wreck their performance or steer them astray, then obviously, you know, the coaching I gave them worked and they liked it. So I guess from that standpoint, it adds some credibility, saying, well, you know, I didn't mess them up. But my point is, if you read between the lines there, it would have been pretty hard for you to mess up an athlete. Like, genetically gifted, highly motivated people can kind of go out and just do just about anything and get some results from it. There's not much a trainer can do with a high-level athlete to make them much better than what they already are. Like, if somebody's, like, the fastest guy on the team, you can't make him all that much faster. And so, you know, what kind of training can you do to make him even better? If no one can catch him, no one can catch him. So, I mean, you can make him maybe a bit more durable, but then that's pretty remedial stuff. So, and I've known guys that have trained with high-level teams where the average guy in the gym who's a gym rat who really studies working out and tests out stuff, you probably have more knowledge than the athletes do. And there's some research to show that they put out a survey, a really interesting survey, to about 350 or 400 Division I coaches and pro coaches. So, like, in all sports, like football, I guess Division I and II football, basketball, and pro football and basketball coaches. And they asked them, what do you do? What information do you use to develop your strength and conditioning programs? And most of them cited what they did when they were athletes, like, you know, in the 70s. And that's it. That's what they do. They just teach the new guys what they used to do. And then part of the questionnaire was like, do you use scientific research? Do you look through the scientific journals? And that accounted for a tiny percentage of the resource they use. Their number one thing to do was whatever they used to do. And then their number two thing was to refer to other current coaches, kind of like what I was saying before, where I collaborated with some of my other coaching colleagues. And you just kind of piece together what seems to be working. And that's it. So it's kind of it's just based on you've done it to yourself, you've done it, and then you're asking other coaches what they're doing, and it evolves kind of on its own, because the science in this field is pretty thin, because you can't really study any one person for that long to get a real measure. It'd be way too costly to actually study someone for 10 or 15 years to see how their entire career of being an athlete and exercising and conditioning goes. So there's no real payoff in that kind of science anyways, so that's why it really doesn't get funded. So it's weird, the information of exercise is sort of stored in a cloud of everybody who's ever sort of gone to a high level of training, and they just collaborate on it, and it sort of grows on its own. And I mean, there are books and, like, programs like ours where, I mean, a lot of it's captured in there, and so there's a lot of reasons why programs are built the way they are. It's just that it's really hard to find a piece of research to one group of research papers that explain exactly why that is, and a lot of it ends up being stuff that's just gained through time over knowledge and collaboration. So it's kind of weird. It seems to be a scientific thing, but at the same time it's sort of an organic thing that you can't pin down to any one body of research.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was actually reading something today, and it was on CBS Sportsline or whatever, and they were talking about elite athletes and stuff like that. And it was really funny. I forget how it came into play, but the guy started talking about Julius Peppers. And I've got experience with Julius Peppers because we played against him in high school. I'm 2 years older than he is, but he was a sophomore when I was a senior. And it was just really funny because, you know, people look at him now and see what an incredible athlete he is now, and, you know, and how fast he is and how big he is and stuff like that. But, you know, in college he was fast and big, and in high school he was fast and big. And it was funny because, I didn't know, but this is the weirdest thing about it. His senior year in high school, he almost won the state track team title all by himself.
Yeah, and that's a perfect example of a guy, like what I was just saying. Julius Peppers was going to be Julius Peppers no matter what he did for training. Like, right. Bo Jackson was Bo Jackson no matter what. Like, those guys are gifted. And this is the thing. This is the cart before the horse or the chicken before the egg. Does he make it to elite-level sports? Is he predetermined to become an elite-level athlete, or the reverse way around? Like, you're just going to end up there if you're that good at sports, because you're just going to sort of find your way there. So it's, you know what I mean? Like if, because along the way in high school, you'll always rise to the top. And they'd be like, oh, well, then you get a scholarship. And then you're kind of in university. It's like people are noticing you, so then you end up getting drafted. So it, and then you find the training. Once you're there, you find even more training. You're like, oh, wow, I can take this guy who is the best all along and make him even that much better. So when you're dealing with athletes, you're taking, like I said, you're taking the best of the best, and you're just trying to make them that much better. You're trying to squeeze like 5% more performance out of them. But I guarantee if he never lifted a weight and never trained, he'd still be Julius Peppers and he'd still be in the NFL.
Yeah, I mean it's tough, man, because that kid, I mean, geez, man, he was a tailback in high school. But you know what's funny, talking about where people gravitate to and things like that, I've got kids, you know, or guys that are my age right now, when we were younger, and we all played the same sports, you know, we all practiced the same, we all swam, we all played basketball, we all played baseball, soccer, you know, some football and stuff like that. And it was really weird because, like, there would be guys that I was on, you know, I played high school basketball with that I was clearly better than, you know, even though we practiced the same, and baseball the same way, clearly better than these guys. But when it came to swimming, even though, I mean, we had all done the same stuff, the same workouts, you know, more or less the same training coming up, they ended up better than I was at it, you know. And so it was just kind of, that was always weird to me how all of a sudden, I remember one guy, man, you know, we trained the same, and all of a sudden, like 1 year, he just surpassed me in swimming so quickly. It was ridiculous. His times were dropping left and right, and mine were staying the same, and it was just so strange to me because we both did the same workouts. You know?
Yeah, and it's just, I mean, some people are shaped for it. Like, there's a reason why Usain Bolt is setting and breaking his own running records. He's the first sprinter that's 6'5", and it takes him, like, less steps just to cover the 100 meters. So, I mean, no one will ever, unless another 6'5" runner comes along, no one will ever catch that guy.
You know what? I noticed? I was looking at video of him, and his legs
go up to his shoulders.
Yeah, but they move the same speed, like rotationally wise, like if you want to get all sciencey about it, like the rotational speed of his legs, like we're going the exact same speed as everybody else's.
Right, but his stride is way longer, so he gets there faster.
Exactly.
Yeah, so that's it. All running is a stride and frequency, and if you have a longer stride at the same frequency, you cannot lose.
Yeah, I mean the frequency was roughly the same. I mean even their feet were hitting at roughly the same, like not exactly the same time, but I'm just talking about looking at their legs.
Like cadence, roughly. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean it was like. You know, obviously his leg would hit a little bit later because he's just got a longer stride than they would with the same, you know, leg movement. But their leg movement was the same. It was really strange. But what I noticed was he was out of the gate. I mean, he was out of the gate so much faster because of his stride. It was like 1, 2, 3, and he's ahead of everybody.
Yeah.
And then he was pulling away a little bit, but then he got to a point where he wasn't really pulling away anymore.
Yeah, no one will ever catch him just because of how big he is.
Yeah, you know what's interesting? They said there's, I don't know, was it a protein or something that high-level sprinters, that all high-level sprinters have? Like they tested every sprinter that they could get their hand on at that high level, and there's this, I think it's a protein or something like that in their muscle. And then there was only one guy, they found that did not have it. So it's kind of like if you have it, you're a sprinter.
There's research, there's some interesting research that shows that all sprinters are descended from one tribe in Africa. Like everyone who's, sorry, not all sprinters, all sprinters who've won the gold medal, you can trace them back to one particular tribe. And then all the gold medal distance runners, you can trace them all back to one tribe in Kenya. Or maybe I think it's even the same place. Either way, the research is out there, but the point is genetics has a huge... This is back to our whole point about your predetermined genetics make a big difference on what kind of level you can get to,
right.
which comes back to our original point that, you know, any Usain Bolt can make anybody look like the number one trainer in the world.
Right.
So it's not that big a deal to actually get your hands on some athletes. Really all it is they trust that you're not going to wreck them.
And I think that's probably more Would you say that, I don't know, and I don't know about this, but when you're dealing with athletes and stuff like that, it's not a matter of pushing them harder and harder lots of times. Maybe sometimes it's more about holding them back so they don't wreck themselves?
Or is that everybody? It's a joint effort. You got to remember, athletes, okay, so when I was training a team, that the coach wants me to try to squeeze any more performance I can out of them without wrecking them. The athletes want to just go, and so then the athletic trainers, the actual like people who deal with injury prevention and stuff like that, and then the team physician don't want everyone's kind of pulling in a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
The coach obviously doesn't want the players to break down, but he wants to win at all costs. So if a player is, you know, going to skate to the end of the ice or run to the end of the field and get whatever the coach wants done, the coach would rather have that done almost at all costs. The player wants to keep playing, so they want to be playing almost at all costs. I'm being paid and asked to get them to be able to do all of that at maximum speed and efficiency. And then the only two people that are kind of ever pulling back are the physician and the athletic trainers, who their job is to make sure they don't get injured. So, like, the athlete themselves, me and the coach, are all pushing the limit all the time. And then the athletic trainer and the physician are kind of pulling back to make sure they don't get hurt. And, I mean, I'm also not pushing them to the point where they're going to get hurt, but the athlete always wants to go. They just won't stop, right? They just want to keep – They would be crushed if they had to sit down because they or be benched because they couldn't. There was something physically wrong, like they couldn't perform. So they're straddling that edge of perform or like pushing themselves to over the edge, and they're kind of hoping I'm just going to bring them to the edge and keep them durable enough to stay right on the edge the whole way.
It's almost like controlled chaos. Like you're right there.
Yeah, they're really close, right? And that's the whole point with an athlete. They are pushing it as far as they can. So, I mean, and then some of them are just gifted. I mean, doesn't mean the gifted ones don't work. It just means it just all sort of falls in place for them. Like they put in some training and it works nicely. I mean, you take a guy who runs a 4.5 and now he's running a 4.4. It's like, well, I couldn't catch him before, now I really can't catch him now.
Right.
So, you know, and as long as you don't break them, like break them down or exacerbate an injury along the way. If you can get them that much faster, then my job is to get them that much faster. And if some other trainer, if some other strength and conditioning coach can do that and I can't, and then that team's going to have people that are just that much faster. But again, we're splitting hairs when you're dealing with athletes. The average person doesn't ever get to this degree of pickiness with the way they train.
Right, so I guess the difference in.
Well, it's kind of like getting a mechanic who works on Ferraris to work on your import hatchback. It's like, who cares? Like, do I really need a guy who can rebuild a Ferrari to change the oil on my Civic? Like, what? Why that skill is going to mean nothing to my Civic?
Hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that makes sense. So I guess when you're maybe picking a coach or something like that, I mean, depending on where you are, obviously, I mean, if you're someone who's just looking to get in better shape, lose some body fat or whatever, I mean, the whole, you know, I've coached athletes before, you know, or currently could be irrelevant, number one, but even more expensive.
Like I said before, at least it tells you that a coach somewhere or an athletic director somewhere or professional or amateur organization trusted them.
Right.
To entrusted them with one of their most valuable things, their athletes. So
right.
At least that person gained those people's trust somewhere. What I'm saying is the nuts and bolts of it is kinda, they aren't gonna probably apply much of what they did with the athletes to you anyways.
Right.
So a trainer who specializes in whatever you are, if you're just, you know, the average, you know, you're the weekend warrior, the average guy who trains 3-4 times a week after work and that's all you do, or, you know, if someone specializes in that and gets great results in that, then that's what you want. You don't care. You don't need the Chicago Bears strength and conditioning coach because, you know, are you a pro linebacker? Do you want to be? Like, no, not really. So, it doesn't mean that they don't know how to get in shape. Like you said, it. You know, maybe Maybe they're too. Maybe they just end up being expensive because of their background, or maybe in some cases they don't know how to pull it back, and they are going to train you like an athlete, and you might be a month into it going, man, this feels like too much. So, it's all relative. It still comes down to the person.
Sure. Huh.
Yeah. It's just, I don't know. It's not like they're going to turn you into a pro athlete. Like if you think that somehow they're going to get you your shot, your shot's probably over if you're not already in collegiate or pro sports.
Right. That's pretty interesting. I don't even think we came over the conclusion if it matters or not. It's just kind of there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's my perspective on it. I mean,
you've done both. So I mean,
I've done both. So I mean, I don't really do a whole lot of what I do with any athletes with. I mean, some of it's built into the programs, but some of it is left out on purpose because it, like really technical lifts, like I would never put a hand clean or a push press or really technical lifts into a regular program because I know that those lifts take like a long time to learn and like hands-on, one-on-one coaching to learn. And I mean, I had trouble teaching high-level athletes that type of lift. There's no way it could come without me being there physically. Or knowing who to recommend in your local area to teach you that. I mean, it would be silly for me to put that on the page and hope that you could figure it out. So that's one of the things. It's like, matching the program to your goals. And I would say, most trainers should be able to figure that out. Should be like, there's no reason for you to be doing, power cleans if you're just trying to get in shape. It's like the risk-reward. I mean, there's a much higher risk that you're going to blow a joint out or develop some sort of form of tendonitis doing power cleans way before you're going to see just, any improvement in your physique from it. So right. It's like fitting the program to you. So you're right. I don't know if we came to a conclusion. I guess my takeaway message is that at least, somebody somewhere has trusted them with their team, with their people.
Right. You just touched on something. I just want to go into this really, really quick because we get lots of questions on it, but, you kind of went into power cleans and stuff and why you don't do those, but the same thing kind of holds with squats and deadlifts too. I mean, we get lots of questions about, why some of those aren't in the program, initially. I mean, obviously you can sub them in, but, kind of go into that a little bit. I mean, I know it's kind of along the same lines, but.
Yeah, I toyed with that a lot. I left out flat bench press, like barbell bench press, squats and deadlifts on purpose. Because all three of those are highly technical lifts that in all my experience, most people end up injuring themselves with those exercises if they haven't learned them properly. And I did it myself before I started training with like a powerlifting team. I was kind of just doing the brute force approach without really refining my technique, and I ended up with a shoulder injury, a hip injury, like, you name it, I messed it up. And that's because I was just a meathead, and I just went strong, heavier and heavier and heavier, and with my bad form all along. And then when I relearned it properly, I'm like, oh, this is how you do this without getting hurt, and this is how you actually really get strong. But that was a very, it was humbling, because I had to take all the way off the bar and go right back down to, like, the empty bar. And then it took a lot of time. And once I realized how technical that lift is and how long it takes to teach it to somebody, if I put it in the program, I have no idea if you know how to do those. So by all means, you can sub out some of the other leg stuff for those things, but I would say most of the people in the gym that I've seen who haven't had the privilege or at least the luck that I had for training with a high-level powerlifting team or even any kind of high-level coach or group that knows how to do that. Most guys just don't know what they're doing in the squat rack. You can read all the magazines in the world. You can even, a lot of trainers can try to teach you, but they still kind of do it wrong. And I had three training certifications before I actually learned how to squat properly. So that's what I mean by it's kind of organic and it's sort of stored in the minds of like a collective group of people. Most training certificates don't even have a hands-on component. Like you can get a certified strength and conditioning specialist certificate that all the guys that write in Men's Health have. That thing's a written exam with no hands-on component. Like you don't ever have to show that you even know how to do the stuff to get that certification. And in the industry, that's considered one of the highest ones. Like I actually wrote an article for Men's Health, and I wasn't allowed to write it unless I had that designation.
Right.
or at least they wouldn't accept it from me, like an exercise article. And I'm like, well, whatever, right? Okay, fine. I have that designation, but it doesn't even mean anything. But most people don't realize that. So I guess that makes it tough when you look at credentials to know what that credential actually means. But anyway, so as far as the squats and the deadlifts, that's why I left them out, because they're so technical. For people who don't already do them, I would never want them to feel like, oh my God, I have to go do squats and deadlifts. And then they try them, and then they get hurt, and they're like, why did you make me do that? I just got hurt. Like, that's why I left them out. So, but anyone who uses them and is confident that they're using them properly, yeah, they're great exercises. I just see too many people messing themselves up. And on that note, leg training, most guys don't do much leg training and don't do it well anyway, so that's why I put in a lot of single leg training, because it's easy and you can progress at it. It's easy to get. The form's easy. The actual exercise is tough, like it's taxing. But the form is easy to do properly without messing yourself up. And incidentally, that's why there's a lot of one-legged stuff, like step-ups and lunges and stuff like that, because two-legged stuff, if you mess it up, or if you have an imbalance anywhere, like in a hip or a knee, you can start getting an imbalanced or an asymmetrical overuse injury really fast when you're underneath a squat bar on a deadlift. You have to really force yourself to be straight and even on that. But with one-legged stuff, you remove any of the imbalance problem because you're only using one leg at a time. So if there's a slight tilt in your hips, well, you won't really notice it because you're only using one half each time you take a step.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting, because I was in the gym the other day, and this was about 2 weeks ago, I kind of started noticing this, and I was like, you know, how many people are actually, number one, doing squats and deadlifts, and number two, how many trainers in the gym are actually having their people doing squats and deadlifts, and, you know, I haven't seen a trainer yet, you know, the last 2-3 weeks, put their person in a squat rack. I haven't seen them put, you know, having them do deadlifts or anything like that with a straight bar. I've seen them do some with dumbbells to the side and stuff like that, but nothing too serious. And, you know, I actually asked the guy who was in charge of all the trainers, and I was like, you know, how come you guys aren't doing squats and deadlifts? And he said, liability.
Oh, you know what? That's a great answer. Okay, how about this? When I was at the University of Florida, we weren't allowed to do in the big gym that all the students trained in. We weren't allowed to do Olympic lifts, like power cleans, hang cleans, snatches, and all that kind of stuff, and clean and jerk. We weren't allowed to do them in that gym because of the liability of like some other person just looking over and seeing what we're doing and trying to do it for themselves. So even though I knew what I was doing, and I'm like, why can't I do this? And a buddy of mine actually worked there, and he's like, well, it's the actual reason isn't because we think you're going to get hurt. It's because the gym, the way the insurance and liability works, they're just assuming some kid in here is going to, like, I'm going to try that and hurt themselves. So they're like, it's not the guy who knows what he's doing that they're worried about. It's somebody else trying it. And then, like you said, at the gym, like, a trainer's, why even bother trying to put someone under a deadlift or a squat if they're paying you for training and then you mess them up under one? Because even someone who really knows how to squat or deadlift, one sloppy rep, if you just lose your attention under heavy squat or deadlift, if you just aren't really focused, you can rip your back up really good under those exercises if you're not paying full attention every rep. And, you know, if a trainer does that to you, you could easily turn around and say, you just messed me up. I can't go to work. I'm, you know, like, yeah, I can see how, from a liability standpoint, they stay away from it 100%.
Yeah, well, not even that. I mean, they would lose money because the person wouldn't be able to pay them anymore.
Well, two things. They'd quit, plus they might sue them, or they might just leave the gym.
Yeah, exactly. So it's pretty interesting. I was thinking about, like I said, I think about stuff, crazy stuff all the time. But just as far as squats are concerned, because I do them from time to time, but, you know, maybe once every 2 weeks just to kind of change it up a little bit. But I don't go super, super heavy. But I noticed I took a step back, because most squat racks, you're not like picking up and then, you know, it's kind of there. You got to take some step backs. So I was like, damn, man, what if I had like 500 pounds on my back and I took a step back and like, I just, you know, even if it's a small step and I just kind of, my ankle just kind of gave a little bit, or you know, and it just I could feel it in my abs just kind of moving.
Oh yeah,
in my back a little bit. I was like, man,
the team I trained with before competition, they practice that. They practice. Because depending for powerlifting, depending where you are, the squat rack is either it's hanging and they take, so the weight is like hanging from above you, the squat rack, and then they can take the rack out from under the bar so you don't have to walk with it.
Right.
And in other federations, like in Canada, you have to like walk out. So you actually have to unrack it and walk. So, and this is with like a lot of weight. So my buddy competes with around 600 pounds. So, but that's around his competition weight. So but before competition, he actually loads the bar up with like 700 and change and just practices walking out with it, like you just said. And he said that alone crushes his abs and his whole core just from taking steps back out of the rack and back into the rack, because he needs to – that's part of it. He needs – and I had a buddy who locked his knee doing that, like his knee like locked on him, and he was out for 6 weeks or 6 months after doing that. So yeah, you're not kidding. Walking, I mean, most people are never going to have that kind of weight on there. But as soon as you have any weight on your back, you got to be careful.
Well, yeah, I mean, the way I'm looking at it is it doesn't even matter how much weight it is, because most guys, when they step up under, their abs aren't strong enough to even support it. So, you know, most guys, the first thing they do is try to figure out how much weight they can lift. So they load up, you know, 225 or whatever on the bar. And they just kind of do it and walk back, and next thing you know, I mean.
Oh, and most guys who've ever tried a squat have never gone to any real depth, like the depth that you need to go to even bother getting the benefit. Like yeah. when I first train anybody with a powerlifting style of an actual legitimate squat, they just can't believe how low a real squat is. They're like, wow, like I, you know, they'll go down there. I'm like, you're not there yet. Then the next one, they'll try to go deeper. I'm like, you're still not there. And when they finally get to real depth, they're like, I can't believe that's how far down you have to go. But people don't realize like how much they're short-legging a squat until they see themselves compared to seeing a real one. And when they feel it, they're like, oh, you're right, right. I was doing maybe one-third of that.
Right.
And most guys in the gym rarely get to a real squat depth.
Yeah. So interesting stuff. Covered a bunch of things. But it's about normal for our calls. Well, about different stuff. But,
yeah, a couple tangents.
Yeah, well, you know, that's life. I mean, Mythbuster style.
That's right. Well, just wherever it takes us, right?
Exactly. And well, that was the whole point. That's why we record it, because good stuff comes out somehow, some way. So.
All right. Well, that's.